Welcome to Bergonomics, demystifying economics with Ross McDowell.
Welcome to the Bergonomics podcast, where we demystify the economics behind events affecting your standard of living. I'm your host, Ross McDowell. Have you tried booking an airline ticket lately? You'll stare at the ticket price in disbelief compared to what you were paying before COVID. The comparative website Finder recently analysed the Australian Bureau of Statistics for travel in terms of inflation. Domestically, Australians are paying 19% more for travel than they did before COVID. Internationally, they are paying a whopping 33% more for travel. This increase can't be blamed on exchange rates, as they're basically the same exchange rate, 68 cents before COVID and 65 cents now. Joining me to demystify airline ticket pricing is the prolific award-winning journalist Angus Kidman. Angus is the editor-at-large for the Finder website. You'll be familiar with Angus due to his numerous television appearances as an expert commentator on the airline and travel industry. Angus, welcome to the Bergonomics podcast.
Thanks very much, Ross. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Angus, many commentators are saying it will be a long time before Australians see cheap air tickets again. Does that conclusion rest on a straight economic discussion of supply and demand? Too many travellers chasing too few seats because the planes were mothballed for COVID and now there's not enough capacity and we've got the price of fuel that's gone up? Or is there more at play here about an industry that's traditionally been very unprofitable worldwide and the profit incentive is finally kicking in a bit more and airlines have decided, no, they're going to try and make more money from us travellers?
I think there's a lot of the airlines trying to make more money from us travellers. I think that's a big factor in it. And we'd actually seen public statements by the airlines to that effect, where they're saying we need to try and return to profitability after a really tough COVID period. And they've actually been fairly upfront about it in a way that I don't know that airlines always were in the past. So yeah, there is less capacity and they can charge more. And I think they're a bit less ashamed of doing that than they might have been. Like, there's always been price competition in some segments of aviation, but it tends to depend on which routes you're on. There are a few routes that are very competitive, but there are a lot of routes, especially in Australia, where there's never been much price competition. And now prices are really reaching these record highs and there's not much sign of that changing anytime in the future.
Well, previously how tickets have been priced, it's been simple. The further you want to book ahead, the less you'll have to pay for your ticket, and you want to fly in economy class or business class or first class, and they're fairly set prices. And so the consumer, the traveler, he knew he could plan what it was going to cost him. And if he wanted to fly a lot closer to the time, it was going to cost him more. They refer to that as static airline pricing, but that seems to have gone out the window now, because that was almost like treating everybody is the same, wasn't it? It would, no matter who you were, you wanted to fly in economy class and this particular seat and you were going to book so many days in advance, you'd all be charged the same price for that ticket. But there is changes afoot, or things are happening to maximise the revenue now. Just lead us into that sort of thinking.
Yeah. We really have seen a big change on that front from, as you say, historically, airlines, they'd price their products the same way as any other business would really. They'd work out, our flight's going to cost us this much to run. We've got this many seats. We want to add this much margin. They're all going to cost the same. And that was historically how airlines ran for a long time. But it did start to actually change really from as far back as the 90s, when computer systems started getting good enough that they could get a better sense of when people were buying things, what kind of people were buying things, and what was going on. So they moved into a much more dynamic model, where what happens now is, while that broad pattern still happens, it is still the case that usually the cheapest fare you're going to find for something will be as soon as that flight goes on sale. The close of that rule still hold, But we're seeing a lot more variation that will go on within that now, where airlines can break that up into more batches of different seats that they'll sell to different people at different times. They might promote them through different channels. They will use what data they have about the customers to try and say, hey, certain customers might be willing to pay more. And they can apply that to the route. They can apply that to the time of day. They can apply it to the class. All these different kinds of things go into it. So now it becomes much more difficult to predict what's the fare going to be on any given route. And that can change really quickly. That can change if you look up the same flight 2 days in a row. The chances of you're seeing exactly the same price are a lot lower than they used to be.
I mean, so I've read that as far back as 2016, airlines were attempting to charge people that owned Apple computers more for their tickets than people that used Windows-based PC computers, because studies had shown Apple computer owners were wealthier. And so if they could figure out what you were searching for in terms of your tickets on what brand of computer, they would give you a different price.
Yeah, and this is a pattern that actually emerged, and it actually started most prominently in the hotel segment. It actually started there. We have a lot of those aggregator sites that will pull together rooms from different places. And they would give very different prices now. And it was based on a not unreasonable assumption. Mac computers are more expensive. So people had, there was this idea they might have more money and you could do that. So airlines have experimented with that model too. Not to the same extent in my experience and from what I've observed. They haven't gone quite as far down that, oh, we'll just pick on you for that. But airlines are in a different position because they are, so many of the major ones have loyalty schemes. They do know a lot more about their customers. They know what things they've bought. They know exactly when they've traveled and what they've got up to. So they're in that position to be able to say, hey, we will make things available at a better or a worse price to people we know more about. And it can go both ways. You often have the case that airlines will make sale fares available to their loyalty program members before they'll make them available to the general public. So it can run in both directions, but it also gives them the capacity to go, okay, if we know that this person is doing this kind of trip six times a year and doesn't mind so much about the price, we may quote them a different thing. So they have that ability in an increasing way to customize on a whole range of things, especially when they actually know who you are. And the airlines, that's pretty common. They tend to be in a good position to know that compared to some other types of businesses where everything is much more transactional.
What about this whole argument about how you book your ticket? There's an instance where a husband and wife who don't share the same surname wanted to fly a particular day in a particular class and a particular airline. The husband booked his wife's ticket on his phone via the app of the airline in a specific seat. He then went to the office, jumped on his computer at the office, went through his frequent flyer account, found the seat next to his wife's seat that he'd just booked, and it was $150 more.
Yeah, this sort of thing happens. And it can be hard to work out what the underlying logic is there, because it may be that the airline has decided, okay, through these different channels, we charge differently. But it has long been the case that airlines tend to have pets of things that they're going to offer. So they'll say, okay, we're going to offer this many seats at this price, then everything goes up. And it could be that in that case, he's just fallen on that gap. He got the last seat that was available for that first price. And then the next seat that was available was going to be sold to whoever came along for $150. And unless you're the person running the airline IT, it's very hard to work out what is actually the underlying cause. But the underlying annoyance remains the same, which is, wow, yeah, you really can find that if you try and book two seats in a row, they don't necessarily cost the same thing. So that has been a pattern for a while. I don't think we'll see it disappear, but it can be very hard to work out how much that's about the channel and how much that's just about, okay, this moment, this is the price that we're doing. So the prices are varying overall, depending on time of day, for instance. That could be enough to explain that without it necessarily being about the channel. It's very hard to conduct a good, decent experiment where you book enough of these things to really work out the underlying logic. I have tried on occasion. See, can I work out what's going on here? But it can be really, really difficult.
So you don't think that booking on an app would be cheaper than booking through the website?
Well, it could be. I mean, that's the thing. Definitely, airlines want you to use the apps. They want, because it's all part of, if you're used to the app, you've consented to all your data being collected. They know who you are. That's kind of built into the proposition in a way it won't be built into the website. So, there can be an incentivization of, okay, we'll do this cheap. But when that happens, they tend to be very upfront about it. They'll tend to say, right, if you book through here, it'll be cheaper. In extreme cases, you might have no other option if you want to book with Bonza, the most recent airline to try and get into the Australian market. you can only book through their app. That's the only way to do it. There's no option to even book through a website. So that those options definitely exist. But in terms of them doing it in a way where they made it cheaper there but didn't tell you, I mean, that's less plausible because airlines do want to try and boast about when things are cheaper. They want to try and act to some extent like, hey, we're trying to offer you a good deal, even while they're actually actively as a business trying to maximize their profits.
Well, then that's part of the problem, isn't it? The public perception, because your airlines tend to be run by CEOs that maybe have fairly harsh personalities and to like the media limelight. And they come across as people that are ruthless and trying to reduce costs and increase revenue any way that they can. And so the public, the traveling public, do you think they've built up this idea in their mind behind looking at people that are running the airlines that, wow, I'm just such a small player and these people are going to manipulate me?
Yes, I think reputationally, airlines in Australia in particular have a big problem. Like they're just not seen as being on the traveler's side. And I think that perception has been building for a while. The pandemic made it worse because things got cancelled. People got given these credits they couldn't use. There was a lot of unpleasantness around that. More recently, we've had the ACCC taking Qantas to court, alleging that it was had cancelled flights but continued to sell them for weeks afterwards. So all of these things feed into the perception that, okay, the airline is not really on the consumer's side, and that if you want to try and get a good deal, it is going to be very much up to you, that you're not necessarily going to expect that the airline is going to do the right thing. From that point of view, it then doesn't come as a surprise to people when they find out, oh, and they might also be doing sneaky things with pricing. Because we're already thinking, okay, we don't really like these brands. So we're inclined to put the worst possible cost on any interactions that we have with them. And yet, if we spot something like that example where you go, wow, this seat was 150 bucks more than the next one, you're going to talk about it, you're going to complain about it. And those things echo far and wide because they feed into this ongoing perception that airlines not particularly friendly towards consumers and to try and get as much as they can.
And in terms of then what the airlines know about us to offer us tickets, which is, we're now talking about the dynamic pricing model, which is something we're going to hear more and more about in the economy, which is basically trying to make the most revenue you can on an individualized basis from any product you sell based upon the information you know about the person. And you've mentioned that the airlines know a lot about us. They've got frequent flyer programs, et cetera. But what other avenues do the airlines learn about you and me individually so that if we then look for a ticket, the information can be used so they can either increase or decrease that ticket price to us compared to someone else? What do they know? Where do they get it from?
Well, they know an awful lot if we have signed up for the frequent flyer program. As you say, that's a good start. But beyond that, there's a huge market now for data about people from all sorts of other sources. So they can try and aggregate data from public sources about you, so something like your LinkedIn profile. They will know things about you from that, but they maybe don't know directly from signing into that. And if you've given the name, it's easy for them to aggregate that kind of information. They can also, some of this is about thinking about groups of people. So it might not target you individually, but there might be an awareness, for example, and you can see this in practice even now in pricing, that if you're a resident of Canberra, you're probably willing to pay higher prices than people who aren't coming from Canberra. That's not such a price-sensitive aviation market. So they might be able to apply that logic, but then double it down with going, oh, okay, and we can see that you're working for a lobby firm, therefore you really want to get there, so we can probably charge you another $100 and you won't bat an eyelid. The potential to do all that kind of thing is there. We haven't necessarily seen heaps of obvious examples of that, but I think it would be naive to assume that's not going to happen. This is, and when you've got this data available, when it's relatively cheap and you've got these systems in place and you've been used to adjusting your prices to some extent based on, what demand that's coming in anyway, we can expect to see more of that. I think as people tap into social media activity, things like that, things that they know about the demographic of where you live, all that is data that can be fed into these systems. I think that's particularly where that's going to get really interesting. We're only just on the cusp of this now. There's all these possibilities for how you can charge things, but currently you'd have to pay an expensive data analyst to sit down and go, okay, these are the things we should look at. Artificial intelligence, AI, takes us into the space where, hey, you could just say to an AI system, hey, here's all the passenger data we've got. What things do you think, that of the people who are spending the most money, what are the characteristics they have in common? And we might not know what to look for, but the AI can just go through that data and you might come up with this unexpected confluence of things that tell you, hey, we know these three things about somebody, we can confidently charge this much more and they'll probably pay it. So I think as that analysis starts to kick in, I think we'll be seeing more and more of this, dynamic pricing personalization that we have in the past, because it's going to get easier for airlines to work out novel ways of working that out beyond those sort of fairly simple tricks like, oh, I'm on a Mac. That's a very basic thing to check. If you can start getting five data points that correlate and you maybe don't, one of those might be a Mac, but one of those might be something much less predictable, it's going to get really interesting to see how much more variation in pricing we see as that goes on.
But could they, for example, now look into LinkedIn and see that there's, let's say, a whole lot of dentists are on LinkedIn and know that there's some sort of symposium on dental work somewhere in Australia on a certain date, and then correlate the dentists that are on LinkedIn, knowing that they're going to go to this meeting, big meeting of dentists, let's say 1,000 of dentists are going to meet in Cairns, and they're going to come from Adelaide, Sydney, Melbourne, Canberra. Link that information, and when those dentists individually go into the airline site or whichever site they go to, it will know that that's where they're traveling to Cairns and it's on that date. So therefore they're going to that group meeting, that symposium, and charge them more.
In theory, you could do something like that. Well, there's nothing technologically difficult about that. The more specific you try to make things, there is a cost associated with doing this. Like, we often think of IT as being there and it's free, but they're going to have, setting up those rules, adding them to the system, testing, making sure they're working does take effort. And so there's going to be a balancing act of going, okay, is that level of personalization worth it for them? Can they make more money out of it? Versus just going, okay, on the 3 days that we know this symposium's on, let's put up every flight that we've got there by, say, 10%. So, which is historically what airlines have tended to do. They've tended to go, if we know there's a high demand period, we'll either put prices up or not offer any discounted tickets there. So I think there's a balancing, but I think these tests are going to be carried out. I do think airlines are going to have a couple of goes at that, but they'll only keep doing it if they can see that it's working, because the risk with any IT-based thing is that if you make it overly complex, you also increase the chance of falling over. And that's not good for your reputation either. And ultimately, if your system is not working, you can't sell things either. So I do think there's going to be a balancing act between, you can make things highly dynamic, but you also have to go, okay, you have to keep them stable. And I think there's a balancing act that's going to be played out there. But I think testing is absolutely going to be done to say, how far down this can we go in terms of maximizing profitability, while also not kind of, again, managing their reputation. They've got to be a little bit careful about, if it emerges, if a whistleblower comes down and says, hey, this is what they've been doing, that's a big reputational slap. Even though from a logical point of view, it's not an illegal thing to do. It's unfair in that sense, but as corporate citizens, airlines, I think, are more sensitive in some businesses about at least being seen to try and do the right thing. So I don't know that we're going to see en masse versions of that happening in the next couple of years, but I'm sure we're going to see testing. I'm going to start seeing slightly more specific examples emerge as part of their basic systems that run all the time.
I read recently about, sounds a bit Machiavellian again, that maybe airlines will have the ability to go through your Facebook account, perhaps see that a close relative had died in another state, and when you look for an airfare to go to that funeral, they'll charge you an exorbitant amount just based on that data gathering.
I suspect that's hard. For one thing, if you've got your Facebook set up so that an airline can freely scrape everything you post and you haven't set privacy, then there's some enablement there, I would say, I suppose. I think people need to be more careful about that. For me, I don't know that the efficiency of individually targeted data scraping would actually pay off there. Like, I think most of the examples of where Facebook information has been used has tended to be used en masse to sort of get at large groups of people. That's tended to be where that's happened so far technologically. So I think we're a way off really seeing that level of airlines leading into that. And again, it would be very hard to work out if that happens in practice, because if you do urgently have to go to a funeral and you do go and try and book a seat for that, typically they're going to be very expensive anyway, because it's within a couple of days. Airlines have had things where sometimes you can ring them and say, hey, can I get a fare on compassionate grounds? that still exists, so maybe you'd use that. So I think it'll be a while before we really see that. But it's not impossible at the moment. I think it's a bit unlikely.
We all look for airline fares. Cookies are an aspect of when you're searching other people's sites. Can the airlines tell what we've been searching for, who we've been searching for it by our browser history, and then model an offer based on our search history back to us, which may change over time?
Depending on what you've been looking at and the kind of cookies that site sets, there is that potential for them to go, hey, you've been doing this. But there's also the potential where they lean into, and you see this a lot now. They know when you've been searching, they'll say, hey, you want to save this query for later. They'll send you an email the next day to say, hey, you were looking at this route. It's actually got cheaper, or seats are selling faster. You might want to get in there. So I think there's a lot of low-hanging fruit in terms of exploiting the stuff that they actively know before they have to go to the extreme of going, let's work out what else is going on here. Absolutely. We already see cookie-based advertising all the time. If you start searching for a holiday to Tasmania, you're going to suddenly start seeing ads pop up on other sites saying, hey, go and do this in Tasmania. And extending that into saying, hey, let's think about what we'll offer you will continue to happen. Whether it works to do that and say, oh, you're interested so we can charge more isn't clear. It may well be, okay, you're interested, we might get you to buy. But to entice the consumer, you might have to offer them a lower price because you're thinking about it. You're doing your research. It doesn't necessarily mean you want to buy straight away. Just to buy, you're looking for a bargain. So then potentially have to offer you a cheaper price in that scenario, I think, not necessarily a higher price. Just you can use the scarcity thing. You could say, hey, you know, seats are how well and for Christmas are selling fast. You can run an app like that. A lot of advertising already works that way. A lot of online advertising drives in that direction. So you could see airlines trying to exploit that more, perhaps incorporating it into their pricing offer. But again, they have to be. It's not necessarily going to work, I think, to go, hey, they're interested in this, therefore they'll pay anything. Working out which scenarios are price competitive versus which ones are, hey, I want to do this and I don't mind, is something that, again, more analysis, more AI is going to help them do that. But I think we're in the early stages of that because there's still a lot of other data sources that they've already got that they haven't fully mined.
But at the moment, there is a whole group of people out there saying, based on my browser history, I've gone in, looked at flights 2-3 days in a row, and they got more expensive. Do you think that the reason why they got more expensive is just the plane was filling up, or it was specific data known by the airline about the individual and said, well, you're going to end up buying this seat. You put it off for 3 days because you keep on searching. We're going to charge you more because we know at the end of the day you're going to buy it.
Honestly, I tend to think it's more that being shamed on a daily basis anyway. I think people attach a narrative to their own searches and go, well, I'm seeing this and the price is going up. Therefore, it's because the airline is targeting me. But without having someone else doing that search completely separate and saying, hey, I'm seeing the same price, you can't necessarily draw that conclusion. Humans, as we know, they're bad at working out how large models work. And they go, well, this happened to me, so that must be how it's working. And I just don't think that is necessarily the case that in every instance when you see a price go up, it's like, oh, they've decided I'm interested, they can charge me more. That's just, historically, that hasn't been the way these things work. Not saying they couldn't do it. I think technologically, it's very possible. But I think people can be quick to rush to a conclusion about what's happened, but they're really basing that off a limited set of data. They're doing one flight search over a few days. Unless you're doing these things constantly, you're not going to see that. And people who fly all the time for work get this kind of intelligence. People who are doing that regular Melbourne Sydney flight every week, which, thousands of people do, they get more used to the pattern of it. And I think if someone like saw that happening, they could go, oh, hang on, this isn't the pattern I'd normally see. But I think I honestly don't think we're at the case yet where loads of airlines are systematically saying, oh, you've done a search, so I'm going to jack up the price. I haven't seen evidence for that being a wide scale tactic that's been deployed.
Just to go back to something you mentioned, there are loads of people flying Melbourne, Sydney, and they get the patterns or whatever. We've done a podcast on petrol prices where studies had been done to show that Australia-wide, Thursday is the day that the price of petrol goes up. Is there a day of the week where airfares go up?
There are days of the week where airfares are maximum and you want to avoid those. So the most expensive times to fly are always Sunday evenings, Monday mornings, and Friday evenings. And it ties in very much with this kind of work commuting pattern, people who have to work one place and come back. So if you're trying to fly at those times, it will always be more expensive. overwhelmingly Tuesdays and Wednesdays are the cheapest days to fly. In terms of the days when things turn over, that varies more and it varies a bit depending on the kind of airline. And airlines, you know, they're putting these things out over a year. Like, you know, you can typically book a seat for most flights up for a year in advance. And as soon as that seat goes on sale, that airline has a good idea of what price history expects to fly to that over the whole, yeah, from that time until the 12 months, the airline will have a pretty good idea what the price is going to be at any given moment. So I'm not so aware of there being that absolutely predictable pattern that you see with petrol. And I think that comes down to, okay, you're looking at multiple competitors and sort of different distribution models. So it doesn't land as obviously in terms of, oh, okay, on this day, everything always goes up. There is some stuff that searching midweek may be better for you, just because on the weekend, lots of people are doing leisure. Yeah, they're doing hunting around, they're looking. And so that's a point when you wouldn't necessarily want to have those super cheap fares out. This is a little bit of stuff where sometimes that doesn't happen, but it really can vary by the airlines. And when they run their sales, lots of the Australian airlines run a weekly sale, which they kind of use to try and promote themselves. And that influences how the pricing happens through the rest of the week. So there's versions of that, but I'm not aware of how they're saying, oh yeah, on this day, it's always going to be Wednesday and all the fares are going to go up. It really, the advance period thing still counts. Generally, whereas you get in first, that's for most seats, that's as cheap as it's going to get. So I know when sometimes the airlines will do the reverse and they'll go, oh, hang on, we're running this anyway. We might as well sell some cheap seats and get some money in. But conversely, at that point, and this is where airlines also get interested, sometimes if the flight's not full enough, then what the airline is going to do is cancel the flight and just say, hey, there's no point running this. It's not going to be a profitable business for us. And that is another, you know, that. And of course, when that happens, if you're one of the passengers whose flight gets cancelled, that's what sticks in your head is like, hey, you sold me this thing and then I didn't get it. So that's another aspect that really can mess with people's perceptions of airlines because it's not the experience that you paid for.
Is that another aspect of dynamic ticket pricing and saying, okay, here we go. We've got the maximum amount of revenue we've got out of this particular plane. Gee, it's just not enough. Let's not do that. We'll just cancel the whole flight and then these people will be forced to go into other flights. But the dynamic model makes that decision for them.
There's definitely modeling goes on for the airlines where they will go, okay, is this flight working? Is there sufficient demand on this? Or can we merge it in? I think that's less about directly to the pricing piece, then going, okay, well, we can actually service this many customers. You see these cancellations a lot on the busiest routes because if Qantas decides to cancel a Melbourne-Sydney flight, it's got another 10 of those going that day. It can probably redistribute those passengers. If it's only doing the once-a-day flight to somewhere more remote, those ones don't tend to get cancelled as often because it just gets messy. And of course, if you cancel a flight somewhere, that has a flow-on effect. Flights don't exist individually. That plane gone somewhere else, it's not doing something else. So it's not quite as simple as just going, oh, we'll pull this one flight because that has a ripple effect across the network. So not to say these things don't happen. They happen all the time. But it's not, I don't think it's easy enough to just go, oh, this isn't making money, we'll just cancel that. And we'll try and, the rebooking people takes time, it gets messy. It can lead to problems. The ACCC case against Qantas essentially comes out of this kind of behavior of canceling things, not letting people know, not giving that information out. And while that's still before the court, so we don't know what's going to come out of it, one of Qantas's defenses was, oh, well, our tech couldn't cope with so many things changing at once. And that does highlight that airlines have sophisticated IT systems, but IT systems are not perfect. And sometimes if you're trying to too much of this stuff going on, it might come back to bite them because actually things stop working. So that's another balancing act that they have to work through as well.
Okay. Looking at some of the, I don't know, tips or tricks that may assist people to prevent them being not overcharged, but charged according to what the dynamic pricing system may determine they can get away with charging the person. Would you recommend that when people search for ticket pricing, they use the incognito mode on their browser, or should they clear their browser of cookies before they make the search?
If people are concerned about it, then both of those are good strategies to go, okay, the airline is going to know as little about me as possible. And those are fairly simple ones to do. So not hard to go into incognito mode, not hard to clear your cookies. Although you'll then find that you've got to log into a lot of other sites to log into before because cookies can be convenient and there's a trade-off there. But if you're concerned about this being an aspect, then those are things that you can definitely do. But I think if someone was going to do that, I'd say, well, go ahead and do that on your computer, but then maybe go through the app on your phone and to see what the difference is, because it's not necessarily the case that you're going to see that difference. You might find that they're the same. You might find, certainly in terms of access to some things, you do need to be logged in to get access to what you're not going to get the same range of options. So I'd be striking a balance between, okay, you can be a little bit paranoid about thinking the airlines are going to do this, but I suspect you might trip yourself up and maybe not get some of the other things that come with being signed in. So my own experience would be, I can't say I'd do that myself. I'm not worried about it enough about it to go, oh, I need to clear my history before I do this. And I book a lot of travel and spend even more time looking at travel prices just to see what happens. So I think that would be an overreaction. But if people are worried about it, then those are simple things you can do without it getting ridiculously complicated.
Okay, I'll give you another specific example. At the moment, the United States economy is, let's not say fairly strong, but it's certainly not weak. The economy in the UK, I think, is in a technical recession. Someone did an experiment. They used a virtual private network and a VPN.
Yeah.
And they selected a US location, priced a ticket, and then they went back in, same carrier, same time, and they selected the UK as the IP address on their VPN. Every time, the UK address provided a lower price ticket than the US IP address, because the airline had figured, presumably, well, UK is going through a bit of a recession. They haven't got as much money to spend on tickets. We'll price it lower for people that want to do it via the UK. The US, stronger economy, will charge them more. What do you think?
So, again, Salesforce, I think there are a few things that tend to happen. It is certainly the case that prices from different markets really do vary. We've seen this again. This is not a new thing. This is not something that's only emerged in the last couple of years. There's long been the case that the fares you will see from booking from different countries on the same service will vary, and they will sometimes vary by more than what you could just account for with exchange rates and whatever is going on with that. Whether that's consistently tied to, oh, we just think we're going to do this. Within those markets, they are going to think about how, what's feasible, what they can sell. In practice as a consumer, there's a couple of reasons that can actually be hard to take advantage of. The main one being that actually, it's very hard. At a certain point, they're going to ask your details, and when you're booking a flight, they're going to get things, especially for international flights, they're going to get stuff like your address. It can be hard to actually get through and pay for those things. You can see the ticket, but it's not necessarily the case. It'd be very hard to go through Qantas's site in the UK from Australia and get it done. And I've actually tried to do that for relatives, and it's actually really difficult. So I think you can see the price, doesn't mean you can take advantage of it. The other thing where people often get tripped up when they try and make that kind of comparison is that the price that you see quoted may not be the full price in all those markets, because there are different laws around what you show. In Australia, you have to disclose this is the actual full price. Like, you're not allowed to say, here it is, and then add taxes and fees later on. In some parts of the US, you can do that. So I've often had this problem when I've not just with airlines, but also with mobile phones, where people go, oh, wow, this phone is heaps cheaper in the US and Australia. And when you after the conversion, it's like, yeah, but you didn't add in the sales tax, because they don't show the sales tax in the US because they don't have to. And in Australia, they do. So I often think that these comparisons fall over when people aren't necessarily actually comparing apples with oranges in this example, and they've got mixed up. So again, I'm not totally sure that I think that happened at scale, and because they've done a macro, they've done that specifically for that thing. But there definitely is the case that the fares you get quoted will vary depending on which market you're in, and that has been a feature, but it can be a hard feature to take advantage of as a consumer.
What about buying return tickets in reverse? Such as, rather than if you want to, I think someone recently told me they're flying from Australia to France return. So they actually bought a return ticket from France to Melbourne, and it was less expensive to do that than a return ticket from Melbourne to France on, I think it was Vietnam Airlines.
Yeah. This comes up more than it used to, because it used to be the case for many years that one-way tickets always had a premium added to them. So you'd find that, buying that one-way ticket was 2/3 of the cost of the return, so you didn't do it. Now, most, even things that are thought of as return tickets, they're actually two separate legs, and they can be priced differently. So if you can work it out appropriately, you may find, okay, booking them that way can work out. There is that possibility of doing that. But again, you have to make sure you can get the booking to work going in that direction that accepts it. And effectively, you're not really booking a return in that case. You certainly, what I would say about that is you're not going to get the flexibility. Typically, if you book that, it's going to be, okay, these are two single sectors and they're not necessarily very easy to change. If you want the full flexibility, something, well, I know I'm flying from Melbourne to Paris and back again, and maybe I want to change that. You'll want a more flexible return ticket and you'll pay more for that. But you always did. It certainly can be worth, yeah, for a frugal traveler, that notion of not, you know, I have to fly with the same airline all the time, that'll be the cheapest, and I don't necessarily have to think of it, you know, the way the airline thinks, but that can be beneficial. There can be real logic in going, oh, well, let's think of each leg of this trip separately and work out what's the cheapest way of doing that. I have known people do the thing of going, sometimes that matters to find a, yeah, they've seen a return that was ridiculously cheap, even if they didn't intend to use the second half. A lot of us go somewhere and go, well, I don't care about the other half of that. It was cheap, and it was cheaper than the single. I wouldn't say that was common, but it does come up once. If you spend a lot of time looking at fares, you'll sometimes find weird examples like that and go, okay, I can think about throwing away this other half of this fare and not doing anything with it.
That gets into these two terms that I'm not too familiar with, but I guarantee you'll explain them really well: skip lagging and throwaway ticketing.
Yep. So skip lagging is, so this is common in the US and a little bit in Europe. And the idea of skip lagging is that sometimes, because of the different ways airline regulations work, sometimes it could be the case that booking a flight from New York to Los Angeles via Dallas, that could be cheaper than a flight that was just from New York to Dallas. So you book the thing that goes through Dallas, you just get off the plane in Dallas, you don't care about the second half of it. That's what skip lagging is. It doesn't happen on every route, but there are certain US routes where it really can be cheaper to get this ticket that's supposed to go somewhere else and just get off the plane. So that can be a tactic for saving money. The downside of it is that by definition, you can only do it with carry-on luggage, because if you've checked your bag into the plane in New York, it's going to get sent all the way to Los Angeles and you won't see it. So airlines also don't like it. And some of them will say, okay, if we detect you doing this, we will cancel your frequent flyer membership, or cancel your points, or ban you from the airline. So it can be, if you're a regular flyer, you wouldn't want to do it. But if you were going to travel around bits of the States, and as I sometimes see this a little bit in Europe, it can be an interesting trick to sort of get through, a slightly cheaper ticket that way. If you've got the nerve to go, okay, yeah, I'm just going to walk out of the airport and not worry about them ringing me and screaming at me. So that can have, and the throwaway ticketing is kind of the extension of that, basically. It's like, you know, sometimes you'll buy tickets, you think, oh, if it's cheap enough, you'll buy it. And if you don't fly, you just won't bother. I used to do this myself back when Tiger was operating in Australia and used to have ridiculously cheap fares. I used to book a family living in Coffs Harbour. If I could buy like a $19 fare to Coffs Harbour, I'd book it for a weekend 6 months in advance. And if I had to cancel it because I had another work commitment, it was $19. I didn't care. So there's still a version of being able to do that. And that typically is low cost airlines that you'll think about that where you think, oh, wow, that's so cheap, I'll book that now and maybe I won't use it. I don't think it's as common now because we're just not seeing fares that are that cheap anymore. And as we said, airlines are now trying to maximize their profitability. So you don't see so many versions of the $10 fare as you were probably half a decade ago, when that was quite a common thing and something that, you know, keen travelers would take advantage of. It's like, book the flight now and worry about the details later. It can still be a good idea if the fare is really cheap, but the fares have got higher, so that's a bit less common now, I think.
Are there any other tricks that you can think of that people can use?
So I do think, yeah, that the willingness to coalesce on those days to not fly on a weekend, that still really helps. If you're trying to get a cheap airfare, in my experience, that is still, yeah, the best area to go for is to sort of say, okay, I don't have to fly on a weekend. If you're willing to put up with a long stopover, this still works. Some of the cheapest fares we see to Europe remain the ones to say, oh, okay, well, you'll sit for 7 hours in some airport in China that maybe you haven't entirely heard of. If you're happy to do the Sydney for 7 hours, you can get much cheaper fares that way. So I think those things can work. I do think for some airlines, it can be better to actually be in their system and looking around than not. I think it's useful to compare when you go to some of the aggregator sites, they have lots of airlines in them to sort of get a sense of, okay, this is what's being charged. But you need to be cautious about doing that for the booking, because if you book through the aggregation platform and there's a problem, you also have to chat to them, not to the airline directly. And we saw a lot of this come out in the pandemic where people were like, oh, I'm having to wait forever to talk to somebody from the aggregator site because my flight's been cancelled and I can't get through. So you need to strike the balance across those. And ultimately, you need to, if you can be flexible about when you're going to travel, you're going to find more deals. And if you've got the time to do that research, then you can potentially also go, hey, I might try this on two different devices and see what happens. But I'm not, I feel like I spend more time just going, oh, hang on, can I fly to a different location or can I do this on a different day of the week? That to me is always where I'm typically going to find my cheapest fares. And it's probably the first tactic that I intend to deploy.
Okay. So you mentioned aggregator sites. Let's look at travel agent versus an aggregator site versus the airline's home site. Which is going to provide you the cheapest fare?
All other things being equal, it's going to be the airline's own site. It is actually, it's fairly rare to see an aggregator having a price that's lower than what the airline is willing to charge. What the aggregator might do is find like an option to you that you haven't thought about, which is why I think people find them useful, because they might, they'll know two or three airlines that are going somewhere, but they might not know all the ones that are there. Where the travel agent can be helpful is if you've got a complex booking where you want to go to a few different places and you want to start joining them together, travel agents still have more flexibility to work that into a better bundled fare. So the occasions when I tend to use a travel agent have been, okay, I have a rough idea of what would cost me to go for a few cities, but I've got a sense that, okay, if I went and talked to a travel agent, they might be able to come up with a packaging of that's a little bit cheaper. So I think the simple returns or simple one-way trips, I don't think that's going to work for you. But if you're starting, if you're looking at more of that round the world version where you think, okay, I want to go to the States, maybe fly to a couple of places, then go across to Europe and do a little bit of that. At that point, it can be useful to have the travel agent and they might get you something that was more worthwhile. And then, the aggregator, I think it's useful to get a sense of the market. But if I found something on an aggregator, I would ultimately, once I'd seen that there, I'd then go to the airline itself and say, oh, okay, how does that actually match up? And also, is it actually there? Because there can be a tendency you get a headline price, but then once you click through, they go, oh, hang on, we couldn't actually make this booking work. So it's not always hyper reliable. So all three have their place. And I think as a research tool, the aggregators are useful, but I would always usually end up back on the airline, both because it'll be cheaper and also because once you've done that, you have done it with the airline direct. And if there are problems, you'll be able to deal with the airline direct at the airport, which won't be the case if you've gone through the aggregators. So I think it's striking that balance.
The travel agents, in years gone by, I believe that they used to buy blocks of seats with the airlines at a less expensive price and then resell them to their customers at a slightly higher price, which may end up being the same price the airline was selling direct for or not. Do they still do that?
Not to the same extent. There was a point where when there were a larger chunk of the industry, they could do that. These days, the airlines tend to control their own inventory more. So it's rare for them to do that for a flight in isolation. If they're selling you a complete package, it's like, hey, here's flights, here's hotels, here's the whole kind of tour experience. In some cases, they may have access, they may have bought in the block of things themselves. But typically, that's not going to be the absolute cheapest price that you're going to get anyway. So I think that, travel agency behavior in that way has changed. And for the most part, travel agents, the stuff that they sell is really, really just flights now. Like, most travel agents I talk to, big chunk of their business is cruising and they're helping people book these complex cruise itineraries. And on top of that, they might book the flights for them at the same time since they're doing that, especially if people are cruising from outside Australia. So that sector is trying to survive by saying, okay, where people need that extra level of advice, it'll work. But flat out flights, it's rarely the case that you can get anything more. And for some of the cheapest airlines, travel agent will do it, but they'll say, hey, we're going to have to charge you a booking fee to account for the agent's time. So you have to allow for that too. That will vary depending on the kind of agent you have. But if you walk into a travel agent and ask for a Jetstar seat, it's highly unlikely that that's going to be cheaper than if you just went to the Jetstar site yourself, because there's just not enough money in it for the travel agent to spend too much time working on it.
The knowledge of the travel agent, that's helpful though, isn't it? To be able to sit there and they can think of things that you'll never think of in terms of booking the flight or from where going to where or what's happening with individual airlines. They might know of airlines that are doing a tough and offering lower fares. Is that still the case?
Oh, yes, I definitely. And that's the thing. I mean, I spend my life immersed in travel. I know this stuff, so I feel like I'd probably be confident doing that. I think there's always going to be a segment of people who are going, I'd like to get a good deal, but I want to talk to somebody who's, And effectively, if you're willing to pay that little bit more at a travel agent, but you think ultimately I get what I want and it's been vetted a bit, lots of people are willing to pay for that service. So I think there's a space for that, but I just don't think it's going to be the way you're going to find the cheapest fare most of the time. So if your price is your number one consideration, you're going to be doing it yourself. If you're thinking, I want the whole package, then again, you're going to say, okay, I'll go and deal with an expert. But I think as a consumer, you should be realistic. If you want to go and deal with an expert, you should expect to pay something for that service. And whether you pay for it directly as a service fee or whether you pay slightly more for the fares because that's where they build their margin and that's what's going to happen. And I think that's a perfectly rational consumer choice to make, but that's the choice you would be making.
Okay. Angus, before you sit the challenge of the Bergenomics test that all our experts take at the end of the podcast, I'm sure it would be remiss of me not to ask you a question that goes through the mind of all frequent travellers. What are the best ways, what are the best lines, the best excuses to use in attempting to get a seat upgrade?
Oh, see, this has just got tougher because it used to be that some of the lines were like, honestly, being tall used to help. It used to be if you rocked up and you said, oh, yeah, and you hadn't booked anything first, you say, hey, can I get an exit row? I'm quite tall, and they would do that. The problem is, as airlines have worked to maximize things, they know that these things are things that they can charge for. So we move from where it's like, okay, if you're lucky enough to book, you can pick the exit row seat or you can ask MD to get it. Now they know the exit row seat is more comfortable, so they're going to charge more for it. So I think it can be, it generally can be difficult at this point to come up with a really good line that's going to get you the upgrade because the airlines are just going, we can charge for this. We can get people to spend their points. We can get them to work through other things. So I wish I could give you a better answer than that, but I think the only times I've ever got lucky with an upgrade, it hasn't been because of the right line. It's been because I was flying with an airline that I had a lot of loyalty points with, and I happened to be the right person in the queue. So I think ultimately that's what pays off. I'm sure there are people who are better actors than me who might be able to go up there and convincingly explain that like they're deeply distraught because their budget gas has died and that works for them. But I just don't think this stuff works on math. The one thing I would say that's not even a line, the one thing that remains true, if you want to get bounced up towards the front of the plane, you need to dress the part. If you rock up there and you're wearing, the pair of stubbies and, just a t-shirt, and that's going to be less convincing than if you rock up and you're wearing a suit. That I think that remains true. That's the one thing I'd probably use, but I wouldn't rate the chances of success being particularly high.
Can they, at the airport, at check-in versus at the gate, who's got the most power in terms of airline employees to upgrade you?
For the most part, the person who's got the most power is probably actually the staff at the lounge. So as opposed to at the desk or anywhere else, like they're the ones who know how many actual frequent flyers are floating around and where you're sitting in that particular ranking. So on the whole, I reckon that's what's most likely to make the difference is actually if you can deal with someone there. And so you check yourself in. The staff at the desk, if you do go and check in, can be helpful. But the reality is now that doesn't happen. For so many flights, you never see a human being before you actually get to the gate. Well, that's the first point you're going to encounter someone because we all do self-check-in now, and that applies even on a lot of international flights. So I think, if you're in that upgrade game, then to get into the upgrade game, I tend to think you have to be a frequent flyer, and you have to be a frequent flyer who's got a bit above silver status before you're actually going to be in the pool kind of getting hold of it. And then your best odds are going to be asking at the counter, and they may, at that point, they may well say, okay, this is cool. We can do that. These days, it's again, going back to the automation piece, you will get the offer in your email. This happens to me with Qantas quite regularly where they go, hey, you could just spend this many points and upgrade yourself on the business. And you'll get that like within a couple of days of the flight. So again, that's where the emphasis has gone. They've gone, okay, well, we'll try and get this, but we'll try and get something out of you for it rather than just offering it. It gets harder to find flights where there's going to routinely be a lot of vacancies that they're just going to offer to people because for them, they'll either sell them or they'll get people to spend their points on them or they'll get people to pay a little more for the upgrade at the last minute. So I fear that the days of, we're just going to bash you the front of the plane because there's something there and I smiled at you the right way, that ship has largely sailed, to mix my travel metaphors, in a terrible way.
Right. Okay. Now it's time to take the Bergenomics test. So we've got the concept of dynamic ticket pricing, an individualized method that the airlines can utilize to maximize revenue based on what they know about you, whether you use an Apple computer, a Mac computer, where you are in terms of income brackets, whether you're a frequent flyer, a whole lot of things. How does the dynamic ticket pricing for the airline industry affect the simple hamburger? Angus, good luck.
I was a bit on this, and it was interesting. You think about it, a burger should be the perfect thing to eat on a plane, but actually you hardly ever see burgers as in-flight food, even though you hold them in your hands, you'd think they'd be great, but they're actually too difficult to prepare. I think in terms of dynamic pricing, we can actually see that this has started to happen in the burger market. Like burgers have moved from being something that were just kind of, you know, sold in great quantities. These days, you know, all the major burger chains, they've got an app. They want you to order through the app. They want to get that personalized data about you. And they want to be in that position to say, hey, we know about you. We know what you like to buy. They want to be able to send you prompts saying, hey, here's a special. Why don't you order this? And as they get to know your habits, they're going to be able to go, hey, it's Friday night and you log in and we can see that like you always want to buy a burger at this point because it's your Friday night ritual. We can start whacking an extra 50 cents on that price and you'll probably pay it because we know you're keen for a burger. So I think they've already actually leapt onto that. They're making their first steps into that space by saying, hey, let's get everyone to go through the apps. And you see this happening certainly with the two big Australian burger chains. They've already done that. And you'd already start to see personalized offers in those apps. So I think it is only a matter of time before you're going to start seeing them be more deeply personalized. And while some will be, hey, here's a free bonus, some of it might be, oh, okay, we're just going to throw this price here and hope you don't notice because other things are going on. So I do think that, yeah, burgers have jumped on this and there's some lessons they can learn from the airlines in the process.
Fantastic. Great answer. Angus, thank you very much. You've enlightened us about dynamic ticket pricing. Perhaps people at this stage are a little bit overly paranoid about it. Maybe it's been blown up a bit too much, supported by a lot of negative recent press about airlines. I think it's AI, certainly in the future, is going to evolve and there's going to be things that we may not even guess about at the moment that will affect our travel habits. But thank you very much. And I look forward to perhaps having you on again and we can talk about frequent flyer programs because that's immense interest too, isn't it? I mean, frequent flyers was like a currency that's really devalued a lot in a lot of people's minds. And people use everything from shopping to purchasing cars, even to increase their frequent flyer balance to then try and fly, but then they can't get a flight. So I think it's another great topic that I'm going to invite you back on and we can discuss that at length.
Absolutely. I'd be thrilled to do that. And I really enjoyed the chat. And yeah, there's a whole world of stuff that goes on in travel that, you know, we can tie neatly back to burgers. So I look forward to it.
Thank you, Angus. Good on you.
My thanks to today's expert travel guest, Angus Kidman, editor-at-large of Finder, the comparison website. My takeout from today's discussion with Angus is pretty simple. The dynamic airline ticket pricing system that overseas airlines use, calculating the highest price a passenger will pay for an airline ticket, isn't yet operating in Australia to the same depth that it does in overseas countries. The full-blown dynamic pricing systems have a very high cost associated with the data mining to discover your most intimate details, and then the IT expense to execute that data. Currently, Australian airlines don't need that expense given the lack of competition in the Australian airline sector. And there is also the huge reputational damage any Australian airline would suffer if their customers felt discriminated against or price gouged. In light of the current multi-government inquiries in the airlines, no Australian airline would risk it. The ticket price variations you are seeing are more likely based on good old fashioned economics. When more people want to travel to a destination on a certain date, the ticket price goes up. If planes are half empty going to a destination, the price declines closer to the date of travel. It's just bad luck for the early ticket purchasers who paid more. So you don't miss a Burgonomics episode, please subscribe via our website and you'll get a shiny new email announcing each new episode, or follow us on LinkedIn or Instagram. And if you have a friend who may enjoy our topics, please mention the podcast to them.